Hello and welcome to an all-new episode of the Three Bid League podcast. As always, I'm Tyler, joined by my co-host, Matt. And we're coming to bring you part three of our team preview series. If you have not listened yet, be sure to go back. 2 weeks ago, we did the Dark Horse Contenders, Fordham, St. Joe's, and Loyola. And then last week, we did the rebuilding teams, St. Louis, Richmond, Davidson, and LaSalle. God, I almost forgot that one. This week, we are going to go into the new rosters, teams that happen to be some geographic rivals here, George Mason and George Washington, and Rhode Island and UMass. Matt, I don't know about you, but I'm just prepared to give the listeners a lot of vagueness in this episode, because when we say new rosters, we're not kidding on these teams.
Yeah, so this was probably the most difficult podcast to ever prepare for since we've been doing this. Usually we've spread it out in the past where each of our team preview episodes will have one good team, one brand new team like this one, make it easy on ourselves. But yeah, all four of these teams are only bringing back, I believe, three active scholarship players from the prior season. So whole bunch of transfers and freshmen coming in. We did our best to research these guys and try and figure out what they're going to look like. But yeah, this is a tough one. And all these teams too, I can tell you right now, they're going to be picked near the bottom of the standings, but they're also wild cards as much as anyone else in the league, because if some of the transfers in particular are good, they could surprise some people.
Yeah. And one of these teams really in particular, I think, has a chance to have an incredibly high ceiling, and another one that may be a little sneaky that I think people aren't quite expecting. But before we kick this off, I want to launch an internet petition coming out of this episode. These recruiting analysts take the time to actually collect two crappy quotes and write a blurb about all these different 3- and 4-star guys. And oh, so-and-so committed to George Washington and so-and-so committed to UMass. Can you please, if you are any of these people, take like a minute and just put in these guys' high school stats? Like, I just keep reading all this stuff as I research some of these rosters today. Oh, this guy, 3-star recruit, one of the best that this school's gotten in years. No stats. I go around and Google. I can't find this guy's stats. Like, people who play for like major prep schools, this stuff just doesn't exist on the internet. Also, shout out David Jablonski, who always does list this.
Yeah, it depends. It's hit or miss. Like, I always try to prepare something for freshmen coming in. But I mean, a lot of times when you watch hype films or whatever, it's guys just blowing by defenders that are 6 inches shorter or just popping a bunch of deep threes and making them. It's really hit or miss. Like, we do our best to try and figure out from the videos and the quotes and stats wherever they are. It's tough.
If you're a 3-star guard going to an A-10 school, I should be able to figure out how many assists per game you had and what your 3-point percentage was.
I do really like, though, the quotes you get when these recruits get interviewed. It's always the same, like, I want to get stronger next year, work on my defense, get my teammates involved. It's like, it's the same two or three things. But I mean, they are all good skills you want to be good at as a freshman, so it makes sense.
My absolute favorite is from the other side. I think it was rivals.com. We'll talk about GW at one point last October landed 3 really good recruits in like a 2-week span. And every one of those little blurbs on the site about those guys started with, this is an important pickup for his on-court skills and because it gives GW momentum on the recruiting trail. Well, I can't believe they just keep building momentum as they get to their 3rd recruit in 2 weeks. Like, I guess they're getting Boogie Fland next.
It's just crazy. All right, last thing. I know we wanted to keep this one on the shorter end, but just one more thing I have to get off my chest. I love the KenPom release day when you get preseason rankings, because people just get so pissed off. And it is one of the best traditions in college basketball we've had for years now. And overall, I will say, I'm actually pleasantly surprised by where the A-10 stands. I thought it would be a little bit more pessimistic, even though there's no top end teams, which we kind of
It's a
expected.
bunch in the top 100, though, which is at
More
least a
than,
better sign.
yeah, more than last year, how we ended the season. So I just thought it was funny though. I mean, you don't need to take a lot of stock into the rankings now, but just to see the reactions is a great moment every season that I look forward to.
My two favorite things coming out of that, the fact that there's only one team projected to truly be like, this loss will murder your resume level bad, and that's GW, who's just such a mystery that actually could end up being decently off. And then the fact that, like, what is with the Fordham fans? Like, they sucked for 20 years. And all of a sudden they're furious because KenPom has them like in the 160s when they feel like they should be in like the 120s.
Yeah, and I mean, I get it too. Like, for Fordham last year, the way you can look at it, and I think one of the reasons they're a lot lower than you might have expected, they finished 137 last year, and by all accounts, had an amazing season. Davidson, who I think the consensus would say stunk last year, was 140. They were pretty much the same team, and just the wins and losses shook out differently because Davidson had a much more difficult conference schedule and also just had a lot more close losses. But I mean, you put those teams together in the A-10 tournament last year, it would have been just about a pick 'em, probably. Not to take away from Fordham's season, but there's reasons why they're a little bit lower than you might have expected.
Oh, and my last one, shout out to the Duquesne fans for being the opposite of the Fordham fans. Because that team added so much good transfer talent that honestly, it just feels like they should be higher for what the algorithms want. Nothing. Nothing from those guys. They're all humbled and possibly just depressed enough to understand, just don't complain. Well, they can. Those guys will be loud if this team actually truly ends up being good. But until we see official proof of it, we're not going to hear a peep.
Yeah, that's probably the right way to handle things. But that's probably enough procrastinating. Should we get on into our previews?
Let's do it. For those of you who are just jumping in on the third episode, which I guess means you're a diehard of one of these four teams, because this seems like a weird place to start if you're just wanting to learn about the A10. But we will go through, we'll go about 10 minutes for each team. Start with key returning players because, like we said, all these teams just lost a ton of guys. Maybe some key questions that we feel. I have an X factor for each team. And then after the buzzer goes off, we'll spend about a minute just talking about what a reasonable expectation is for each of these teams, what we think their fans will need to see this year to be satisfied with how the season went. So we'll kick things off with the George Mason Patriots. Their two returners, Ronald Polite, who ended the season on one hell of a heater, nearly making enough of a case to get himself onto the all-conference team late in the season. And then Malik Henry, who's just kind of bounced in and out of the rotation at the power forward and center spots over the past few years.
How can you say that after all of your preseason hype last year for Devin Dinkins to be the rookie of the year? He's back too,
Oh my
unless
God,
I'm missing.
Devin Diggs isn't going to play. Like, this is actually where I wanted to start. Mason sneakily ended up with a bunch of perimeter guys who are all going to be deserving of good minutes. Like, I seriously don't see a path for Devin Dinkins to get on the court unless he got way better over the summer.
Well, he's going to have some competition because the new head coach, the only first-year head coach in the A-10, Tony Skin, had to rebuild the roster through the transfer portal since pretty much every other key rotation player from last year's team either graduated or is playing for Providence this year. But a couple high-profile transfers, I think the main ones to start with, Jared Billups from Siena and Darius Maddox from Virginia Tech, both putting up some solid stats. Played a ton of minutes last year, both averaging around 30 minutes a game, and should be able to step in right away and you would think contribute at the A10 level.
I want to give a quick asterisk here to make sure that you meant only first-time head coach in the A10 this year,
Yeah.
because Ryan Odom is at VCU now.
Yeah, that's true. Well, he's coached though, as a head
We didn't
coach.
do our preview for them yet. We haven't done enough research to know that. All
That's
right.
true too.
The two guys coming in, Billups and Maddox, I see them as the most likely starters next to Ronald Polite. And they're both going to bring something really different to this team. Billups, every person who watched him play at Siena just raves about him as an ace defender. And Sam Fetterman, the master of MAAC basketball coverage, told me that he's even a good kind of secondary rim protector. It's a guy who can sneak over and get some blocks. And I think that George Mason brought him in expecting him to be the leader of their defense from day one. Darius Maddox, a guy that we talked about briefly in our top 21 players pod, I see him as being able to bring a similar impact that Deshaun Schwartz did 2 seasons ago. They're very, very similar players. Guys who were quality starters on NCAA tournament level teams who kind of got pushed into this like fifth man kind of role guy spot, inconsistent shooters and scorers, but certainly showed flashes of big games, a solid but not elite defender, and a guy who's really just got a full all-around skill set. Someone who really just brings kind of a diverse array of skills that you rarely see in a mid-major conference from an incoming veteran transfer. Normally, you got to either take a shot on raw talent that hasn't produced, or someone who has produced that maybe is coming up from a lesser spot. Like Darius Maddox, no matter what, even if he gets nowhere near his ceiling, I feel extremely confident saying that he is going to be a flat out above average starter in this league.
I like the comparison to Deshaun Schwartz, George Mason getting another transfer who got minutes at a high major school, produced well. And I wouldn't dig way too deep into last year's stats, especially since he missed a lot of the end of the season with injuries and other issues going on. But 2 seasons ago, went over 50% from three, 40 for 79 for a good Virginia Tech team. I think one of the questions has to be just, will he be able to take on a more expanded role than he had with the Hokies? Because you would think Mason might rely on him and Polite to carry more of the load offensively. But yeah, I mean, agree with what you said on both those guys. And then Billups in particular, too, only listed at 6'4", but I mean, he could be up there with some of the bigs in terms of rebounding numbers for this squad.
Yeah, and one of my big questions was not necessarily can Maddox take on a hugely expanded role, but knowing that he's going to be a much higher usage guy, can he continue to shoot the ball the way that he did early in his Virginia Tech career? 50.5% as a sophomore. Now, granted, he was only taking about two a game, but he bumped that up last year and it immediately fell to 32. I just look around this roster, and outside of him and Polite, I think they're going to be very, very light on shooting. And while Polite ended up closing out at 37% for the year, that was a huge, huge jump from earlier in his career. So I feel good about him maintaining that. I'm not sure there's much growth to come there. Look around the rest of this roster to incoming guys like Woody Newton, Billups. Like these are just not guys who have shown us a history of being able to provide the level of 3-point shooting that Mason's going to need if Maddox isn't that knockdown guy.
Yeah, you just have to wonder where that outside production's going to come from outside of them. I mean, Keyshawn Hall's another guy who shot the three well in a limited sample last year at UNLV, but I mean, otherwise, you would think a lot of the production is going to have to come from the front court. And Mason did a really good job bringing in some rim protectors. We already know Malik Henry, even though he hasn't had a huge role, just kind of being buried on the depth chart behind Josh Oduro and then Oji Akpo last year. But Amari Kelly, formerly at Duquesne, and then UNC Wilmington last year comes in. Nicholas Prevret, a 6'11 junior transferring from Central Michigan. I mean, George Mason has a lot of size this year. And even though it doesn't look like outside shooting is going to be a strength, I think this could be one of the most difficult defensive front courts to deal with.
they're going to be incredibly physical, and I think that this will be one of the better rebounding teams in the league as well. But my other giant question is just, what do they get out of those centers? Do they have a true A-10 quality starter out of that group? And I really like the guys they brought in if they're all your 22 minutes a game third big. Amari Kelly was a very streaky backup at Duquesne who showed some incredible flashes. He's grown into a far more consistent player since then. And he's a guy that is just no doubt a quality rotation big in this league. Malik Henry, I think, proved over and over last season that he was. And I really felt like he was their second best big guy behind Oduro last year. Kim English just kind of wouldn't play him down the stretch. And it was maybe the most confusing thing about the Patriots to me late in the year. Pavrett's another guy. Like, if you look, he has basically the same numbers as Isaac Jack, who's going to be the backup center for Dayton. Both played against the same competition in the MAC last year. Like, we're thrilled to see Isaac Jack as the just kind of part-time backup for Holmes. I'm not sure I would want to see him as my starter. And so they got a lot of quality options here, but unless Jalen Haynes can unexpectedly get a waiver, he was an all-conference guy in the SoCon last year, but even if he does, he's only 6'8". He's a little under-heighted for that position. I just don't know if they're going to have the type of center that you want to match up against, not even necessarily a Holmes, but maybe like the Loyola front court against Chad Venning, these better big men in the league. It's going to have to be some sort of very cleverly thought out rotation from Tony Skin. All these guys are going to have to find ways to contribute in partial minutes.
I really think it's going to just have to be a committee between those guys, because in particular, Henry and Kelly, both really high foul totals. I mean, neither one of them have played extended minutes at any point in their careers. And even though Kelly in particular, I think his offensive stats and defense really are a lot better than what we saw at Duquesne way back 3 or 4 years ago. He has really struggled with foul troubles, about 7 per 40 minutes last year. So I think you're right about Tony Skin just needing to find the right mix and match of guys. And overall too, it just feels like they brought in a lot of good individual defenders, but I think that's going to be a challenge as a new head coach with 10 newcomers on the team. Can he turn that into a good team defense? And that's something we really won't have an answer to until we see them play a few games.
Yeah, and I should note, especially if any Duquesne fans are listening, Amari Kelly last year at UNC Wilmington, 7.8 points a game, 5.5 rebounds, shot 58% from the field. Like, he actually became the exact guy that I personally thought he was going to turn into. Just kind of a quality starter in a little bit lesser of a league. I think that makes him a really good A-10 backup. And I just can't believe he still has eligibility. 4 years ago, it was an actually really fun Duquesne fan conversation of what freshmen should be getting their backup center minutes between him and Austin Rotrov. And then it felt like Austin Rotrov was in college forever. And somehow he's gone before Amari Kelly even came back.
Yeah, I think the amazing thing, if I have this correct, George Mason has two A-10 players that were in the conference when we started the podcast, because they also have Trey Wood, who started out at UMass, believe it or not, spent the last couple years at LIU, and we didn't really touch on him much yet, but he'll be another backup point guard option to Polite and Dinkins.
Yeah, 4.3 assists last year, actually coming off the bench, even though he played huge minutes for LIU. That's where I talk about, like, Dinkins probably not being able to get minutes. I think Trey Wood basically stole his spot in the rotation, and it's fun to see him back too, especially because I saw the name and for some reason I thought he was the giant third string center they had back in 2018. Not this little 6'1 point guard. But three names I just want to run through real quick that we've basically somehow not talked about. And this team has a ridiculously high ceiling. They just took shots at all these dudes who could really be good, but also on the flip side might just not even be rotation players. And the epitome of that is Woody Newton. originally at Syracuse, went to Oklahoma State last year, started about a dozen games for the Cowboys, but just really did not produce anything on the offensive end for them. He's a 6'9 guard. And he actually goes back, if you look at his bio, he was one of the top 20 ranked power forwards in his class years ago. A little concerned that he started out as a power forward at a power forward size and is now listed at a guard with no production. Like, when you have a guy built like that and all of a sudden he becomes a guard when he's not playing well, he might just not be able to do the things 6'9 guys are supposed to do.
Well, he mostly just shot threes in his career. And I mean, I still think starting in the Big 12, even though Oklahoma State wasn't one of the top teams in that league, he's at least got high level experience.
Yeah. But he comes down to be a massive mystery. And he's not even my X factor for this team. And this is where I got to extend the clock here for a moment, because we somehow did not talk at all about Keyshawn Hall.
Mm-hmm.
Four-star recruit, went to UNLV for a year, a guy who had multiple Power 5 offers, both coming out of high school, and then again this spring. I couldn't see if they ever like truly offered him, but there were rumors that schools as high up as Ohio State and Louisville were interested, although Louisville's not that high up anymore.
Yeah, I think I agree with you, though, on Hall. I mean, just looking at him last year, he was a true freshman. Like, if none of these centers work out, I feel like Hall could physically handle that position, both as an outside shooter and a rebounder. Just seems like a really versatile guy. Missed a lot of games last year, I'm guessing, with injuries for UNLV. But, no, I think very high ceiling, though, based on the limited stats he put up last year.
Yeah, and he was somebody who kind of struggled to break their rotation. He showed a big flash in mid-January, and it's one of the weirdest game logs I've ever seen. He starts and plays 26 minutes at a Utah State team that eventually goes to the NCAA tournament. 19 points on 6 of 11 shooting. He comes back the next game, 4 of 6, 10 points with 5 rebounds against Fresno State. Then his minutes get dashed again, 4 of 4 shooting for 10 points in a win against Wyoming. And then he was basically just on the fringes of the rotation the whole rest of the year. Like, I've never seen this before. This guy was finally gets a chance, stud recruit. He's awesome for 2.5 games, and they just stopped playing. And he played in the next few games, so it's not even like he was hurt for that stretch of the season. So it's just absolutely bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers in a small sample were pretty solid, but it is curious, especially considering UNLV wasn't a great team last year. So the fact that he wasn't playing a lot is confusing, although if it works out, I feel like he could definitely play for this Mason team.
Yeah, he could even end up being their second or third best player. And we should close out because we basically just didn't talk about Ronald Polite. And he kind of earned that with his late season performance. And if anybody wants to hear more about him, go back. We interviewed him over the summer on this feed. Interview still timely and relevant at this point. I had him as a surefire top 10 guy. You and Tristan did not share that same sentiment. And which one of us is right could actually dictate like two to maybe five spots in the standings for George Mason. If he's the superstar I think he is, this is not a pillow fight team. Like, basically under any circumstances with the talent they have.
I think that's right. And I mean, what we talked about with him too many weeks ago, his improvement since stepping on campus in Fairfax has been remarkable. And I think that is a huge boost with so many new faces on the team having a point guard that played so well last year. He's got to be the glue that holds the team together. I mean, if you want to nitpick his stats last year, the turnovers were still pretty high. If he can get that assist to turnover ratio up, get his teammates involved, help them get open shots, because like you said, this isn't a team with a lot of proven shooters. That could be what takes George Mason from a pillow fighter to middle of the pack or even better than that.
All right, real quick to wrap it up, expectations. I think that this team fan base wise might actually have the most reasonable of any in the conference, because these fans are so happy for one of the stars of the Final Four team to come back. Tony Skin, he spends a bunch of time as an assistant coach for great programs. This is where he finally decides to take the step up, to come home after all the garbage of stinking through the Hewitt and Paulson eras. And then Kim English gives you a spark, but you kind of always knew that he was going to leave you. Like, he was the lady that you met one night in Vegas, you married her, she's incredible, but you're just some schlep, and you kind of know in the back of your head, like, this can't last. And Kim English was always just too shiny of a resume to not move on unless he stunk. And I think they all knew that. So if Tony Skin comes in here and keeps this team out of the pillow fight, keeps them around 500, gives the fans a reason to stay engaged all year, I think they'll be plenty happy with that. And I think that's incredibly reasonable, and they can easily achieve it.
Yeah, I don't even really have an on-court expectation for any of these teams, just because it's so hard to know. But I think you kind of hit the nail on the head. I feel like for Tony Skin, his goal should just be building the hype for the George Mason program that Kim English used to talk about for the last 2 years and didn't really have time to build on. But you would think with a former star player being the coach, I mean, that's exciting. That's going to get a lot of alumni fired up. And I think that just has to be the focus right now, getting people engaged, getting more people at the games, and hopefully you have a good season too, and that just accelerates the process.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. And I won't go into it for people who won't understand, but any deep Game of Thrones fans, Kim English is Ser Jorah's wife from the story early on of their tale. For the like three people that actually understand that and listen to this show at the same time, I hope you enjoyed that. All right. That took like double as long as it should. Let's go to the George Washington Revolutionaries. Gone is the Colonials nickname, but back, James Bishop, the Rookie of the Year, Maximus Edwards, and hey, Keegan Harvey's still on this team after his injury. The stretch five, who flashed some really nice moments in November and then immediately got hurt, and we lost the fun of getting to see him.
Well, let's just get our Keegan Harvey segment out of the way. I kind of forgot he was even playing in November. I just remember him being hurt all year, but a 6'11 guy who, out of his 19 field goal attempts, 17 of them were threes. Who doesn't love to see that?
I don't even remember what game it was, but he had like this incredible 8-minute run against like Coppin State or something, where he just looked like the most athletic guy on the floor. And I'm just basing all of my hype and expectations on him just on that.
So I think for George Washington, in comparison to George Mason, we're going to have to spend a lot more time talking about the freshmen, because that's where a lot more of their minutes are going to come from, I think. They did get a couple fairly high-profile transfers, probably the biggest one, Benny Schroeder from Oklahoma, one of the top international prospects out of Germany a couple years ago, and just never really had a chance at Oklahoma, dealt with a ton of injuries last year, only played 6 games. And then they also bring in Antoine Smith Jr. from Evansville, solid three-point shooter who should play on the wing. I mean, I would think between those two guys, hopefully that gives GW some shooting that was a strength of the team last year.
Yeah, and I think those transfers actually are going to play a huge, huge role. Antoine Smith Jr. is just kind of a guy that I feel like we haven't seen at GW in a long time. Just this rugged, versatile, can play both spots forward, decent three-point shooter, solid rebounder for his 6'7 size. Like, that's the guy that Jamie and Christian just never bothered to get for this roster. And it's actually kind of the exact player that they were missing last year. Just a big dude who can actually play some defense, because, God forbid, basically no one was doing that last season. And just a reliable role player. GW hasn't had them. Another grad transfer they brought in, who's also pretty unique for what we've come to see from this team through their last years of their rough patch, a giant center by the name of Babatunde Akinbola, who was playing at Auburn last year, although playing may be a stretch. He was on their roster and occasionally got in for a minute or two. He's a skinny 6'10", 6'11", see, 6'10". He's a skinnier 6'10 guy who's going to be one of the major, major keys to this GW defense. A guy who's a four-star coming out of high school, even though he only scored 6 points a game. Well, you don't really have to read between the lines to see that a guy with that level of scoring to be rated that highly means that he is going to bring you something pretty nice on the defensive end. And I can't remember the last time they had an actual physically imposing rim protector on this team. Like, yeah, Hunter Dean was solid at it, but when you're driving to the hoop and you saw Hunter Dean coming at you, were you ever really that scared?
No, and I always wanted that to be Noel Brown, and maybe it will be at St. Bonaventure now, but yeah, I think Akinbola is one of the more interesting transfers just because, like you said, came in as a highly touted prospect and has just never gotten any playing time at Auburn. Although you look at his situation, last year he was playing behind Johnny Broom, who is All-SEC second team, and the 2 years before that, he was behind Walker Kessler, who's in the NBA now. So now we can pretty much guarantee he'll be in line for more playing time. I think he's pretty much the only true center option GW has, unless you think he and Harvey can play there, but or if GW just plays small for a lot of stretches next season. Yeah, he's going to have to play for this team.
And by the way, he was also stuck behind shot blocking and dunking God Dylan Cardwell, who is my favorite random power five player in the entire country. And I hope that dude gets big minutes this year. But as an aside to bring it back, the transfers that you talked about, I was about to call Chris Caputo Jamie and Christian. I apologize for what would have been an insult there. He struck gold last year with Maximus Edwards. Guy who goes off to Kansas State, immediately gets hurt, and things just aren't working out, so he leaves. He went and did that with two guys this year, trying to basically replicate it with Benny Schroeder, who actually did get on the court a little bit for Oklahoma last year, but then also Darren Buchanan Jr., another mobile 6'7 guy who comes over after showing up to Virginia Tech and never getting on the court.
Yeah, and I kind of think Buchanan is the insurance where if it just turns out Akinbola can't play extended minutes and isn't a reliable center. I mean, Buchanan's 6'7", 235. Physically, he came in as a good rebounder and just redshirted last year at Virginia Tech. So no stats. We don't have any proof of it. But at least coming into Virginia Tech, that's what they thought they were getting. And yeah, I mean, I think his versatility, that's going to be big because losing Lindo and Dean from last year's team, stumbled over it again. The Revolutionaries, they lose a lot of their physicality from last year, and I think Buchanan can help with that.
Yeah, and as important and as steady, really, that was the key piece from those two last year. As steady as they were, this team's a lot bigger, they're a lot more athletic, and they're a lot deeper in the front court this season. So while we really have no proof of any of these guys contributing anything on the college level besides Smith, they have a hell of a lot more options than last season, where like a Ricky Lindo foul trouble problem was like almost a death knell for this team. They couldn't survive without those two.
I mean, yeah, I kind of had to remind myself of it, but at the end of last year, GW is basically just playing seven guys. I mean, they didn't have a single reliable bench player.
Basically just playing five, and then they just kind of threw in the other two when they had to.
I think that leads into one of my biggest questions about the team, though. Last year, the offense was probably the most entertaining to watch. The defense was a travesty. They were terrible. And I think a lot of that can be attributed to just having a thin rotation. They weren't able to play aggressively because their guys had to stay in the court. But what strides do you think they can make on that end of the court? It seems like they've got some more athleticism and depth coming in. But I don't know, do any of these guys in particular stand out where they can make a big improvement on that end?
I don't see the like Jared Billups, like we just talked about with George Mason, that stud that you can just rely on. But I think it is just the combo of more athletes being able to play your bench. And James Bishop was never a steady defender, neither was Brandon Adams. Hunter Dean kind of give and take. Like all these dudes that they were relying on, there was no kind of top end, maybe even no above average defender. And a quick little plug for the Believe in DMV Hoops pod. Chris Caputo went on there a few weeks ago, talked about he put together this year's roster with two goals: to be a better shooting team and to be a far more versatile defense. I think that's the most important part. And to me, one of my big questions, can this team start to actually force turnovers with all these athletes they have? 325th in the nation last year in turnover percentage defensively. They were just bad on that end. They were the opposite of the mayhem teams in the past. Like the one thing GW could actually do well under Jamie and Christian, they were really, really bad at in year one under Caputo.
I feel like some of that help might need to come from the freshman backcourt because we kind of know Bishop isn't going to sell out defensively. He's got to lead this team offensively. He's going to be asked to take a ton of shots and also have the ball in his hands a lot, get his teammates involved. But two freshmen I want to talk about real quick, Ja'Quoy Hutchinson and Trey Autry, both physical guards with some length. And at least we've seen Caputo talk about them having good reputations as defenders. I'm just interested what GW gets from them because last year, this was the worst perimeter defense in the conference, both in terms of forcing turnovers and they also just got torched from three. I really think that those two young guys are going to have to step up. And I don't know how many minutes they're going to play, but they're going to have to bring some energy on defense for this team to be improved on that end.
Yeah, and I'll throw in Christian Jones as well as a guy who could potentially play big minutes in the backcourt for them. Those are the three guys. They got all of them in a 2-week span in last October, a trio of three stars. And Ja'Quoy Hutchinson is actually, at least according to his bio on the GW website, the highest ranked GW freshman recruit since J.R. Pinnock in 2003.
Wow.
J.R. Pinnock, the multiple time all conference guy on some of the best GW teams ever. Also, I just kind of can't believe GW hasn't gotten a 4-star in the last 20 years. That seems impossible to me.
I would have
But
thought Yuta would have been just to get off topic.
probably just because
It's
he was international.
yeah.
But
Well,
they're going to need my biggest question, not even necessarily on the defensive end with those guys, although just like with St. Joe's freshmen, they're going to need one of them to step up and kind of cover some of what they lost when EJ Clark got hurt last year as their go-to, hey, this is a perimeter guy that can actually consistently get some stops for us role. I just think they have to find a secondary playmaker next to Bishop. And I think Maximus Edwards will slide into more of what Brendan Adams was able to do last year as kind of his co-star scorer. Just an two guys who can really carry this offense. But if James Bishop is your only playmaker, despite the fact that he did a pretty good job as a point guard last year, better than I think either of us ever expected he could, he was great moving the ball. But if he is your only main playmaker, your offense is going to take a big drop off this year. And so one of these young guys has got to step in and make up for some of what they lose with Brendan Adams.
I think that's right. I think it could be Benny Schroeder, just with his buzz coming in, just not playing a lot last year, but put up some solid numbers over the summer at the FIBA U20 Championship, averaged 15.6 points per game at a pretty high level of basketball. And I feel like where we'll definitely see Bishop and Edwards, even though both those guys can get to the rim, a lot of their strengths are also outside shooting. I feel like Schroeder's going to give them that bigger guy that can drive the lane and get to the rim.
Yeah, and Schroeder's my X factor for this team. I think he has a chance to be a star in this league and potentially very quickly. We talked about him in depth in one of our transfer episodes earlier in the summer, so I'll keep it brief, but he was the MVP of what is essentially the German second league 2 years ago. He was a massive scorer, pulling in about 8 rebounds a game in there as well. Not a big time outside shooter, but someone who will take them occasionally and shoot them at a decent enough clip that you certainly can't ignore him if he's standing in the corner. And he's exactly the type of guy that if they do have that third guard who fits with Bishop and Edwards, all of a sudden Benny Schroeder could give them a whole nother level of dynamism that they weren't getting from their forwards last year. And that's the scenario where this offense goes up a whole notch this season. And if that happens, they're definitely not a sub 200 team.
Yeah, I mean, I think after seeing what happened last year and just what made it so fun to watch is GW's efficiency, and they were one of the best teams at the rim in the country. I think Schroeder's going to be a big help with that. I think Maximus Edwards, again, will play a lot of that role. But yeah, I mean, this offense, if the transfers work out, could potentially be up near the top of the league again. Defensively, I kind of need to see it to believe it, but I mean, I could definitely see a world where this ends up being an upper middle of the half team if everything pans out.
Yeah, and that rolls into the expectations. And my hottest take of this episode, I kind of am bummed out that James Bishop came back for this one reason. If he leaves, the expectations are dirt nothing for this team. And all of a sudden, it's just all of these athletic young dudes playing with Maximus Edwards. They would be one of the youngest teams in the country, I'm pretty sure, without Bishop. And they would have ended up losing one or two terrible non-con games. Everyone would have quit on them. And then all of a sudden, in the middle of January, they would have gone on some sort of run where they're just flying up and down the court, and Edwards is throwing down these massive dunks, and Schroeder's starting to grow in his game. And all of a sudden, we'd blink, and they might even make it out of the pillow fight. And if that had happened, like, we'd get to have conversations about how Georgetown should have just gone and grabbed Chris Caputo instead of paying Ed Cooley all that money. This could have been a team that I think has a chance to be pretty good this year, but the floor is also super low. And with Bishop back, they do have a chance to potentially disappoint on the backswing.
Yeah, I think keeping Bishop, who was pretty much a consensus top three player in the league last season, I think that has to keep some expectations despite the analytics hating George Washington, and for a reason. I mean, they have to replace a ton of production, but I feel like now that they got a taste of success last year and started to build so much excitement for the Chris Caputo era, I really feel like the expectation should be avoiding the pillow fight going around 500, because it just feels like if you tank and finish in the bottom three, that does wear off a lot of the goodwill that was bought last year, and you're kind of starting over again.
Yeah, I think it's maybe not even necessarily make it out of the pillow fight, but be somewhere.
Just being competitive.
Yeah, like 11th or better, I think, essentially, to put a line on it. And my lone expectation for this team, I like the name change, but Ryan Paleo, if you're listening, please tell the people in the student section, do not make up shirts that just say, "Let's revolutionize," because that will kill all of the hype around this team. That would be terrible. Please don't do it. It's an awful pun. I don't want to see it.
Yeah, we'll see where GW. How long is it going to take us to get used to saying that on the pod? Because I already slipped
I
up.
I cannot
twice.
Believe I didn't screw it up here. So
yeah, I had to work hard not to more.
All right, the Rhode Island Rams. I'm gonna like flat out miss one of their returning guys here, but
there's only three.
Well, they bring back Brandon Weston, Rory Stewart, Joseph Epbalau comes back after an injury in mid December. I felt like he was establishing himself as the Rams' best center option before he went down there, and so his return will be very, very welcomed.
It will be, although I think he is missing the beginning of the season, if I'm not wrong. Tore an ACL in December, but you're right, he was playing quite well for the Rams, and once they get him back, that'll provide a lot more skill inside. But just like all the other teams we're talking about in this episode, the Rams really reloaded with some transfers, both in the backcourt and the frontcourt. They kind of had to replace everybody. I don't even know. I feel like we could start just about anywhere on this team because pretty much everything's new.
Well, they overhauled that whole backcourt. Four guys to really keep an eye on immediately. You've Luis Courtright, who was a four-assist-a-game guy at Quinnipiac, led the team in steals. Fun little fact, he was the leading scorer with 15 points on opening night last year when Quinnipiac went into the Ryan Center and beat Rhode Island.
Yeah, first game. Also, my fun fact was that that game was a triple nickel because he also had 5 points and five rebounds and five steals.
Yeah, he did. Jaden House, who I think is going to be the name that most people bring up first, big-time scorer at High Point, third in the Big South in that category. Not a greatly efficient player, though. Zeke Montgomery comes over from Bradley, a dead-eye sniper, 42% from deep last year, a guy that the Rams really just didn't have last season. And then one of the fantastic names in college basketball, always right, moves on up from junior college where he was just a dominant do-everything guy, like putting up one of those all-around scoring, assists, rebounds, steals type of stat line that you expect from the 6'3 guy who's playing high school with a bunch of dudes who can't match him athletically. And I guess Cam Estevez as well, a really hyped up freshman, although he's going to have to fight his way into the rotation behind all of these guys.
These guys are simply going to have to be good because Rhode Island's offense was a complete disaster last year. Really, it came down to Ish Leggett just putting the team on his back, and he individually had a great season, but this team had absolutely no outside shooting, struggled with turnovers. Just really the only thing they did well, which was kind of consistently a strength of Archie Miller's teams at Dayton and Indiana, they got to the free throw line a lot. And I feel like a lot of the guys that they're bringing in this year are going to continue with that. Getting contact, especially Jaden House, who gets to the rim as much as just about anybody. But it's going to need to come with improved field goal shooting and just three-point shooting, because otherwise it's going to be ugly just like last season.
So this leads right into the undoubted biggest question with Rhode Island. Outside of Jaden House, who I think even if he drops off from an efficiency standpoint, with what this team has, he's going to put up enough shots to be able to give them a decent scoring spark. But I don't know where they're getting the points from these other guys unless it is just a combination of Courtright and Wright and Montgomery are all basically as good as we believe that they probably can be in their better case scenarios. The free throw thing, you're right, it was great for them last year, but that was also largely because Ish Leggett was elite nationally in that category, and Jalen Carey was pretty good as well. Brand Freeman, not spectacular, but he had the ball in his hands so much that he still got to the line a good amount of times. All those guys are now gone. And other than that, this was a disaster. Bottom 50 offense in the country, according to KenPom. You know the last time Archie Miller did that? Never. He had never even had an offense that was in the bottom half nationally. Like, this was a complete 180 from what we're used to seeing from him. And even the defense, which basically checked in right around dead average, was still the worst of his career. The only thing that was even close in that regard was his first 2 years at Dayton when he had basically Brian Gregory's players still.
I think a lot of this really is, at least on the offensive end, I mean, House, like you already mentioned, is going to get a lot of the attention just because of his gaudy numbers at High Point. But last year, Rhode Island just really struggled with point guard play, whether it was Breon Freeman leaving the team during the season or Sebastian
leaving,
Thomas's inconsistency.
Getting thrown out, yeah, well, something.
He's trying to be nice. But I think Luis Courtright is going to be a key for this team. A really solid assist rate at Quinnipiac, who, by the way, was a solid mid-major last year, so he's been around some winning. I feel like it kind of starts with him because outside of Zeke Montgomery, I don't see a ton of great three-point shooting on the team, but last year this was kind of like a lot of teams in the A10, a really low assist rate team that just didn't have a lot of flow. They had to do so much through Leggett. I think Courtright kind of needs to be the engine. And even if he doesn't score as much as last year, he's going to need to be the facilitator on this team to get other guys involved.
Yeah, they need an above average starter quality year from him or from Always Right, if maybe he just becomes the breakout guy that jumps ahead of him. Those are probably the two most important guys to this team. For me, I actually said that the X factor was Brandon Weston, who I just think is flat out better than his stats say. Super athletic guy, unquestionably the best forward on that team last year. He was never aggressive with the ball in his hands. I wanted to see him shoot more. I wanted to see what happened if he was more aggressive attacking the basket. And it's one of those guys that I really have no true backup to say that he's a potential breakout guy in the way that I believe he is. But just when you were watching with your eyes, watching Rhode Island, he was the one guy who popped off the screen for them athletically outside of Freeman. And I just think that whether it's Archie giving him a more important role or him just going ahead and taking it, he has to become a good quality starter for this team this year.
Well, I think you just have to look at it if you're rooting for Rhode Island and Weston, you have to look at it through the lens of him being a former top 100 recruit who was recruited to play at Seton Hall. And I can't think of.
And you could see that guy on the tapes throughout the year,
Yeah, you could,
just
but I
in
can't.
really small flashes.
But I mean, it makes sense. Like, can you think of too many worse offensive situations for him to be a part of as a freshman? I mean, I think it is encouraging that he is back for year two. And with those flashes, I wouldn't be surprised to see him get a bigger role. He should have a clearer path to playing time now. But yeah, I mean, he was kind of, I know you mentioned Leggett, Carey, some of those other guys who are gone now, but Weston was solid at drawing fouls and getting to the line. I feel like that's where his strength is going to need to be again, unless he becomes a better 3-point shooter, but just 27% last year.
Yeah, but and that's one of the things I'm talking about. He was drawing 3.5 fouls per 40 minutes. It was basically the same number as Jalen Carey. Just for him to get to 40 minutes was taking like 3 games. So my biggest question for this team, like, where is this going? What is the plan for the future here? They came out last year and immediately went young, and they took shots on talent. They took a shot on Freeman. They took a shot on, I want to say that North Carolina kid's name was Harris. I don't even remember at this point, who just could never become academically eligible to play and then ended up leaving the university. And it just didn't work. And I looked at them as this is a 2-year plan. They're going to develop these guys, and some of them will stay and some of them will go. Hopefully, they nurture some good contributors. And then they have a great freshman class coming in for this year. Well, some of those guys that were supposed to come in this year ended up decommitting. Cam Estevez is probably the biggest name who stuck around and is still showing up. But they didn't bring back the contributors. And like Rory Stewart just kind of wasn't quite the stretch big that he was hyped up to be. And I don't know what Rhode Island's trying to build here. Because these guys that they brought in, Courtright and House and Montgomery, they're all decent little players. They're all down to 2 years of eligibility already. And like this team, and Archie Miller said last year at Media Day, don't expect them to play the way that they did at Dayton with the undersized like Kendall Pollard at the five lineups. Like Malik Martin was not going to do that, and he didn't do that last year. But what those Dayton teams were best at, versatility on the defensive end at all five positions, and really just having a bunch of guys who kept the ball moving constantly. I don't see a roster that's capable of having those two things this year. Their big men are all just kind of big and clunky again, same as they were last year. Like, I don't know where this is headed for Archie if this year is not a significant success.
Yeah, I get what you're saying with that. I think part of it, you almost have to look at it like what Duquesne went through the last 2 years. I mean, you're right that Rhode Island lost pretty much all of its production from last year, but when you go 9-22, how much of that production do you really want to bring back? I think a fresh start isn't the worst thing. It is just interesting where last year Archie brought in the big name transfers. They didn't work out. This year, he's going the JUCO route. I mean, another guy we didn't talk about, Tyson Brown, who averaged nearly a double double last year on what ended up being a good JUCO team. I don't know. It is an interesting configuration. And unless Rory Stewart becomes a 3-point sniper, or I do like one of their 6'9" freshmen, David Fuchs, who had some good numbers in Germany last year. It's one of the top international prospects in the league. But unless one of those guys really breaks out in the front court, it very well could feel like last year's team.
Yeah, and that Duquesne team, like you could kind of see the identity they were building towards. We talked about Loyola a few weeks ago. They were worse than Rhodey last season, but I can see what Drew Valentine's going for. Like, this team just doesn't feel like an Archie Miller team to me from the skill sets that they've acquired. And I almost feel like they just kind of went to get those guys to make sure they don't finish in the basement this year. And then maybe they figure it out in year three.
So what are the expectations? Because I feel like the expectations were very high, or let me put it this way. When Rhode Island hired Archie Miller, I think their fans and probably us too figured by year two they'd be pretty good, or at least contending for the middle of the pack. Can they even get there this year?
At this point last year, I assumed we would be sitting here at this moment saying, "Hey, Archie has the guys now. This should be a top half of the league team." And I think top half would be a significant victory for them at this point.
I think so
Like,
too.
God, is the expectation at this point just don't finish in the basement?
I
Like,
feel like the.
and either Cam Estevez or Always Right or Fuchs ends up being awesome, so they have something to build on for next year.
Yeah, I feel
I don't
like
know.
the
I'm just down on this
expectation.
program, man. I just feel like they should be in a better place with Archie Miller in month like 17 on the job now.
I would have thought so too. I mean, his track record, the excitement we had when Rhode Island got him, that's what gives me hope that he knows what he's doing. But at least on paper, I mean, it's not, doesn't seem great, but we'll find out. I mean, he's surprised us before.
All right, we'll close out today with the UMass Minutemen. They returned both of their point guards from the end of the season, Rashul Diggins and Keon Thompson. They returned their versatile power forward, Matt Cross. They had a whole bunch of freshmen. It was nine, the most in the country, although we found out earlier today that Sawyer Mayhew, one of their big forwards, is actually not going to be on the team this year. So it's just eight, but they had a bunch of freshmen. They add the NEC Player of the Year in center Josh Cohen. And Frank Martin added the only podcast to be hosted by an A-10 coach.
And the biggest addition of the offseason. This is an interesting team coming off just a wild season where it's hard to remember that UMass won the Myrtle Beach Classic Invitational. They won a tournament. And as soon as Noah Fernandes got hurt, things just went off the rails. But I think the important thing to look at for this year, I mean, one, it feels like they brought in a lot of Frank Martin type players just athletic, aggressive defenders. They're going to run a deep rotation again, press teams, run a deep bench. But I don't know. You feel like all these guys are going to need to be ready to play based on what happened last year. And I think this was a stat we had when we talked to Curry Hicks Age, but led the nation in bench minutes last year. So I feel like any type of rotation is possible.
And you mentioned that these all seem like Frank Martin guys. And one of my biggest questions for this team, I'll go right into it. Can these freshmen bring the proper toughness to satisfy Frank Martin and satisfy what he wants to see out of his system? I felt like one of the few things that went well for them during that disastrous stretch of conference play in January and early February was that the older transfers he brought in, Conte, Levesque, Brandon Martin, and to a lesser extent, two of the returning guys, Noah Fernandes when he was on the court and DeAndre Dominguez, was the toughness and aggression that those dudes constantly brought to the point that it swung some games for them against better competition. All those guys are gone now. How do you instill, if you're Frank Martin, that level of toughness into a bunch of young dudes who, let's be honest, that's not typically the focus of most freshmen that you bring in, and especially a lot of the guys at the talent level that he's bringing in. This is not Mark Schmidt, like pre-Putnam pipeline, bringing in dudes from Pennsylvania coal towns who are one-star recruits who want to prove themselves from day one. Now, there's a few completely out of nowhere unheralded dudes in this group, but I look at the fact that the most talented guys in this group, a pair of guards, and Jalen Curry and Robert Davis, were big-time scorers in high school. And maybe they have that gene, maybe they don't, but that's always a tough transition for a guy who was a ball-dominant scorer, an absolute stud, to then walk in and now just flip the switch to be a grit dude immediately. It tends to take some time.
I'm curious to see what happens with Jalen Curry because, I mean, on paper, he might be the most talented freshman in the league. At one point in his high school career, ESPN had him as a top 50 recruit and thought this was interesting. I tried to do some homework and found a post on him on the UMass message board from the NIL collective. And they basically said without NIL, they don't get a guy like Jalen Curry. Maybe that's just hyping up their brand, getting people to donate. But I mean, look at his offers coming from the likes of Alabama, Xavier, Florida State. Really good pedigree. I feel like on a team where even though two of the returners are point guards, he'll have the chance to get some minutes. And then Robert Davis Jr., the other guy you mentioned, sniper, three-point option, something that UMass is going to need. This was a team that shot the ball very poorly, both inside and out. And, I mean, just in general, they're going to need some scorers. And he seems like, in terms of the freshman, he could be one of them.
I think getting Curry's kind of the same as them getting RJ Lewis last year.
Mm-hmm.
High-ranked recruit, ton of Power 5 offers. His recruitment kind of got stalled out by a bunch of those teams going hard into the transfer portal and essentially making him wait. And then UMass swoops in with what we have reason to believe was a pretty good NIL offer and the promise of the potential of a lot of minutes. And I saw RJ Lewis play in person the last week of the regular season, and I walked out of that court fully prepared to put him in my top 10. A-10 players going into the season. And then sadly, he transferred. Now, that's a high bar for Jalen Curry to cross, but by all indications, he's basically that level of a talent, at least as a recruit.
What do you think Keon Thompson and Rashul Diggins need to do to ward these talented freshmen off and keep their roles as starters? Because they both had their moments last year, I think mostly in the second half for Thompson, where he started 9 out of the last 10 games, had some big assist games at times. And then Diggins was just as wildly inconsistent as you could get, missed some time with injuries also, but he blew up for a couple big scoring games too. Do you think UMass would have the most success with these guys figuring it out and being reliable starters, or will the path to success come more from the new faces on the team?
Well, first off, I think they have to be the steady hands for this team. But if they're both starting together in February, then either Frank Martin really, really loves having that experience on the floor to start the game, or it's a sign that these young guards just weren't good enough. Because every best case scenario for UMass involves Curry or Davis being a big minute stud at the two guard spot. And I think you basically have to stagger them anyway. Like either Diggins or Thompson should probably be on the court basically the whole game at the point guard spot. But these were two guys that as of like mid-February, kind of didn't look like they belonged on an A-10 court. And once the UMass roster started to shift, they both took a big step up to close the season, to the point that Diggins is my big X factor for this team. Coming in with the UConn pedigree, being a huge disappointment early in the year, and then really looking like a true A-10 caliber starter for about the last month. He's so, so critical to bringing these guys along, being able to get someone like Jalen Curry good spots, good shots in good situations on the floor. If they're both bad, UMass is going to be bad. I think it's as simple as that.
I agree with that, but I think in terms of getting teammates good shots, one thing I don't want to get lost, and I think the really big newcomer that we have to talk about, Josh Cohen was one of the highest assist men in the NEC last year, not to the extent of someone like Neil Quinn, but I think we all just know him as the 20-point-a-game scorer, elite post-up option that UMass is really going to need. But 2.5 assists per game last year, I feel like he's another guy, if you want to talk about steady hand. I mean, he's played more minutes than pretty much anyone else on this roster. And I feel like clearly the Minutemen will need his efficient scoring inside, but I think just distributing and helping other teammates get good shots up is going to be critical.
He's going to be the hub. He is the sun, moon, and stars to this team now. And the way that Frank Martin has always wanted to run his offense in the most ideal situation is to have that Josh Cohen type guy, someone who can be a brutal scorer in the paint, but also with a touch of playmaking to him. And so my biggest question for this team, can you win in a league as good as the A-10 in 2023 running a team like that? And we saw Martin try it last year. He would go to it in various different points with Levesque, with Conte. Neither of them were good enough to hold down that role in this conference. You saw him even try it a little bit with Matt Cross, but Matt Cross he's just not big enough to do that as a center in the way that Martin would ideally like to see it. Josh Cohen has the tools to be a star in this league. It's a very weird player to project for that reason, though.
Yeah, I would peg him as more of a playmaker than Levesque and Conte, but it is going to be interesting just to see how he pairs with the other front court options that UMass has. I mean, potentially him and Matt Cross could be one of the most dangerous scoring duos at the 4 and 5 spots in the league, but just kind of remains to be seen how well those guys mesh together and some of the other options too. I mean, I think we'll see a lot of Daniel Hankins Sanford at the 4 or 5, a former Frank Martin commit who stayed at South Carolina last year and then transferred after just a rough season for the Gamecocks, but in limited minutes put up some pretty insane rebounding numbers. I think the offense still needs to develop, but at least out of those guys, I feel like Hank and Sanford could really provide a big defensive and rebounding boost.
Before the timer goes off here, I just want to ask you, can you name the last two NEC conference players of the year? And you only need to give one last year because I'm pretty sure they had Coe.
Well, Cohen had to be one of them. I'm never going to get it. Is it an A-10 guy?
It's Josh Cohen and Isaac Conte.
Wow. How did I miss that last year?
Yeah, because that, like, as much as we've hyped up Cohen, there's just this piece that lingers in the back of my mind that Conte was just coming off the bench for this team all of last year. Cohen's numbers were still better in his player of the year season than Conte's were, but, like, it can't be forgotten.
If Josh Cohen is just Isaac Conte, I think you're looking at the last place team. But I think he's better than that. I mean, his stats were very impressive last year. And, I mean, it's a piece that UMass badly needs. I mean, especially, we talked about it a ton last year, but the two-point shooting was just awful. I mean, they could not finish at the rim. And Cohen is going to improve that so, so much. But it is a big question, just how his game's going to translate to the A-10. It's a lot tougher level of competition.
All right, expectations for this team. I'm not even going to give an actual like record or spot in the standings. I think that the best thing that can happen for this fan base is for them to love Frank Martin again. Things got testy at the end of last year, and that's the double-edged sword I have in this dude. When things are bad, he seems like a lunatic, and he's going to drive you crazy, and you're going to drive him crazy. But if he starts winning, and all of a sudden these great high school scorers are tough as nails two-way dudes, the UMass fans are going to be ecstatic. So I think if this team shows enough to make fiery Frank Martin a cult hero again and not a dude who's trying to fight his fans in press conferences, I think that's all we need to see to say that the Minutemen are coming back on the rise.
I think that's a good expectation to have. And I think something that will help that come to fruition is just this team needs to play a complete season. I mean, believe it or not, going into the game on February 1st, this team was 13-8, and it just turned out they were cooked. I mean, they were completely done at that point and ended in a 33-point loss to Richmond in an empty Barclays Center. If that's how the season ends again with a disastrous February and March, then they're not going to love Frank Martin. So I think that's just what it comes down to, you getting the freshmen to buy in and play hard where you're still, even if the season doesn't go the way you hope, that you're still competitive and you're not an easy out at the end of the season.
Yeah, and let's make it clear, in that A-10 tournament game, that team quit.
Yeah,
like, I mean, they went down in the first 3 minutes and they flat out gave up. And you see a lot of those guys are not on this team again. So we'll see if Frank Martin team version 2.0 can keep it up this year. But to close out this episode, I just want to note something that just kind of popped into my head looking at all these teams together. Because it just continues to be so weird that George Mason is a really old team with a brand new coach and a brand new roster. And we kind of got to see the different pieces of this from the other three teams we talked about today. GW, Chris Caputo comes out and goes and gets an old roster last year. And I know most of those guys were returnees, but they were all in the transfer portal. Caputo decided it was worth the time and effort to go bring back Bishop and Adams and Dean and Lindo. A few of those guys we thought were basically gone, and then all of a sudden they showed back up on the team. And I think it helped GW from the perspective of, hey, he got to establish in year one that he is a good coach. He gets to tell these recruits what he was able to do with James Bishop last year. Like, this team outperformed last season. It was a testament to him. And on the flip side, we have a guy who we know to be a great coach in Archie Miller, who went super young last year. It flopped. And now we're wondering if he can still build programs like he could 10 years ago. And Tony Skin, I wonder, him being someone who, by the way, played for Chris Caputo when Caputo was an assistant coach at George Mason, I wonder if maybe there was a thought of, hey, let's go old. Let's make sure we're good in year one. And then we can work on building a foundation of young guys afterwards.
That's an interesting thought. And I think with the experience, George Mason, at least to me, feels like they easily have the highest floor out of this group. I don't want to completely give up on anybody that we talked about tonight just because of all the uncertainty, but I mean, that is a pretty good comparison. For me, it's harder to see a situation where George Mason just bottoms out, where with anyone else, I mean, all bets are off. You don't know.
I'm not quick in any way to truly insult people when they put out their power rankings. These people that have George Mason at like 13, 14 just flat out just didn't do research. There's too many quality older dudes on this team for that to happen. Like, we just see this over and over again. If you can just assemble a roster with 8 to 10 rotation quality guys, which they clearly have, you're not a bottom feeder. Now, maybe this team still finished 11th or 12th and they just kind of stink all year, but I can promise you they are not a basement team. There's just simply no chance.
I think you're right. Well, we made it through the unknown wild card episode. I think that went pretty well. I'm excited to talk about the favorites next week, though. We've gotten through, whether it's the trendy picks, just the complete rebuilders, but finally getting to the good stuff where we really dig into who can win this conference.
Yeah, come back next week for what actually ends up being two of the three best rivalries in the A10. Sorry to the Arch Barron Cup fans that SLU didn't make the cut for this episode as they typically would. But we get Dayton and VCU, and we get both halves of the For Real Cup, St. Bonaventure and Duquesne. I feel like Duquesne just kind of like spiritually took St. Louis's spot in this episode for this year. So be sure to tune in, listen to that. As we mentioned at the top, be sure to go back and listen to part one and two if you haven't already. And then we'll be wrapping it up with another episode or two before the season comes. We got about a month left. Everybody continue to get excited. College basketball right around the corner.